Yes. Hello, and welcome to the podcast where we look at theology, tradition, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and we throw it all away. We ask, what do I believe, why, and what does the Bible say? Anyway, and we build reconstructed faith. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. This has been a transformative few weeks for me. My buddy just got a big contract, and I've been doing a lot of work with him, which is a good change because I haven't been working for a few months now due to COVID, and I'm quite sick of being home all day and being stuck with myself. But that also means I've had a lot less time to work on this podcast, which has actually been good also. It has taught me time management. It has taught me to be much more focused in my research. Another thing, I know we are big on learning context and digging deep into the theology of our beliefs and figuring out how salvation works and why it's important, but I need to apologize. I have not stressed enough who God is. The Bible is a unified work that tells a story of Jesus Christ, and sometimes I lose sight of the person of God through the trees of how he saves and what it all means. Don't lose sight of God or his glory. If you remember back to the episode on what is the Bible, I made the point that it is all about God. And somewhere along the way, I have lost sight of that. Don't do that. It's not healthy. Theology is important, and knowing what you believe and why and being able to defend those beliefs are very important things, but not at the cost of relationship with God. That's why I've changed course. This was going to be the final chapter in the Salvation series where we talked about being saved by faith. We were going to discuss the purpose of works and whether or not there is any justification in works. And finally, ponder whether faith itself is a work. But let's instead start a series on the characteristics of God. People say all the time he is a loving God. We hear that idea that God is love thrown around both in the church and outside of it. Well, if God is love, we can learn a lot about God's character by studying love. So let's start there. What is love? Well, indeed, what is love? If you really think about it, we live in a post-love society. Because love has been conflated with sex and with infatuation, we have this idea of butterflies and feelings of elation. And then when love isn't what we think it is, we change partners or we swear off love altogether. We live in a society of free sex. Sex no longer has anything to do with love. Hell, if we are honest, it no longer has anything to do with reproduction. It's something we do because it's fun and it feels good. We're told it is natural and to have all the sex we want to. But before we spend a bunch of time there, can we agree that love is complicated? The Bible uses a couple different Greek words to describe love, and I wish that English was that detailed. Because think about this. We love our parents and siblings one way. We call sex, or at least sex with our partner, love, or making love. It's the same word, but those are two very different feelings. We also love our friends, and that's different still from how we love our family. And then there's love of neighbor, the concern for their well-being, and these are all love, at least in English. But Paul uses two different words in the Greek to describe love. The Greek themselves, however, had six words for love, and modern psychology has adapted these and actually added one. We'll be going over the seven types of love, and how they relate to society in the Bible. So before we get to the topic at hand, let me remind you real quick. The mission of Reconstructed Faith is to look at the Bible without a theological lens, to leave tradition and theology at the door, and view the Bible on its own terms. We use the original languages of the Bible, being Hebrew and Greek, and Aramaic for the Book of Daniel, to drill down onto words and see what the Bible is really saying. We look at the culture that surrounds the biblical authors to look for clues that can inform how to interpret the text. The Bible was written for us, but if we are honest, it wasn't written to us. There was an original audience, a recipient of the message at the time God inspired it. And that is when knowledge of culture and existing paradigms of belief help inform the text. Many Christians these days either don't read the Bible, or if they do, it's in the form of some devotional tidbit with maybe a soap study method, and they know nothing of context or biblical language. It's all eisegesis rather than exegesis, which means it is what the Bible means to them rather than examining the text for its actual true meaning. Reconstructed faith exists to get Christians into an exegetical mindset to look at the Bible through the lens of the Bible, to put our mind into the framework of the Bible instead of the Bible into the framework of our mind. But there is a lot of information out there and a lot of podcasts. I need the help of partners willing to donate for an ad campaign and the design and maintenance of a good website. In the description is a link to Patreon, as well as a PayPal link if Patreon is not your thing. And if you can't afford to donate, just like and share the heck out of this podcast. If you are blessed by it, why not share that blessing? Why not get in on the podcast craze yourself? Start a podcast. I did. It doesn't have to be this elaborate thing. Get a friend, talk about life, record it. Boom! Life according to insert name here. That is you, by the way. If you do, use Buzzsprout. Use the link in the description and get yourself a $20 Amazon gift card while you're at it. So as I said earlier, modern psychology has actually taken in this Greek idea for the six types of love, plus the addition of self-love, which the Greeks did not have a term for. Eros is sexual attraction, passionate love, most similar to our modern idea of romance, but not exactly equivocal. Eros is actually the root word for erotic and erogenous. In Greek myth, Eros was the result of being shot by Cupid and was seen as some form of madness. The Greek culture was obsessed with logic and philosophy. You see, Aristotle and Socrates, self-control, discipline, democracy, they feared Eros, because they saw it as a threat to their self-control. As an example, when Paris was struck by Cupid's arrow and was stricken with love, see Eros, for Helen, it caused the fall of Troy. Greeks see Eros as the enemy, or the opposite of logos, which means word, but is also our root for the word logic. Now, this is actually deeply significant. John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In the Greek, this famous verse says logos 3 times. Jesus was referred to as logos by John. Now, if Eros is seen as the opposite or enemy of logos, one can see rampant, out of control sexuality as the opposite of Christ. And that was an aside. I actually didn't even plan to go there, but my mind just started spinning, and it was like, boom, logic, logos, eros. Yeah, I kind of just went there. If we look at the use of eros in the Bible, we will actually not find it. Even when Paul alludes to bedroom activity in 1 Corinthians, he never speaks of eros, because the culture of that time feared it so much and considered it to be a form of madness. We live in an eros culture. Sex is everywhere. Watch any movie. You meet a girl or a guy, and you go on some adventure together, and halfway through the movie are in bed with them. You haven't dated, you haven't got to know about each other's hopes and dreams or your families or how you feel about kids, but there you are inside of them, or them inside of you, whichever it may be. And yes, I did get a little graphic there, but I did it to show the absurdity of this idea. But the world doesn't think it's absurd. They worship this idea. Look at the world around you. This is runaway eros, a world full of pedophilia, 27 genders, and no consequence sex. We use murder as birth control because we value sex more than human life. If that offends you, I am sorry, but that is the truth of the matter. When we are confronted with the truth and we are offended by it, we have two options. One, we can refute that truth and say it isn't true. I don't believe that. And then we are, as James says, the man who looks in a mirror and forgets what he looks like when he turns away. Or we can let the truth illuminate our lives, and we can align ourselves with it, however painful, and use our image in the mirror to wash our dirty faces. Okay? So that's what eros is. And the Bible doesn't really address this version of love, except to talk about lust. Philia is the broadest, most common type of love. This is brotherly love, or the love of friends. This is where the city of Philadelphia actually gets its name from. And the Greek verb phileo comes from, which is a word meaning to show warm affection. It is basically the action of showing philia. This is also the root word of the word philanthropy as well. Philia causes us to have a meaningful fellowship with others and to be heartfelt, honest, and loyal to one another. In the Bible, we see philia in a few places, actually closer to a dozen. My favorite time, though, is at the end of John. Jesus finds the disciples fishing after his resurrection. You see, after his resurrection, he would come and go, often showing up only for a moment to give a lesson or have a meal, and then he would be gone. It had been 40 days since the disciples had seen him, and he found them unchanged. They had returned to fishing. They were exactly as they were before. Now, if you remember the Easter story, Peter was scared, afraid and confused, denied Jesus three times, just as the Lord said he would. Well, here, Jesus says to Peter, "Do you love me more than these?" Peter answers, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Feed my lambs," Jesus replied. "Do you love me?" Jesus asked him again. Peter this time says, "Yes, you know that I love you." A third time, Jesus asks, "Do you love me?" The text then says that Peter was distressed and said to him, "Lord, you know all. You know that I love you. Feed my sheep." This is Jesus both as Lord, but also as Peter's friend. using philia. Peter, are we friends? You denied me. Are you sure we are friends? It's Jesus giving Peter the chance to redeem himself. And then establishing his position as leader by telling him to feed his sheep. Related to philia is storge. That's a storge, pronounced like storge. And it is familial love. It's often unilateral. Everyone has it for each other, but it's asymmetrical. If we're all honest, some of us love our dad more than our mom or our sister more than our brother. We have favorite family members. It's asymmetrical. Meaning sometimes it's one way and you don't have the same amount for everyone. It's also not dependent on attraction or personality. You love those who are your family because they are your family. That's storge. This isn't really mentioned at all in the Bible because Jesus and also Paul usually elevate what would naturally be storge and demand an even higher form of love, being agape. If you think about a relationship, it's interesting. Typically, you start with eros, then a relationship becomes a mix of eros and philia, eventually ending in storge. It's a familial love, love with a spouse because they are family, while still maintaining philia and eros, at least in a healthy relationship. But God demands more, at least from men, because we are to love our family as God loves the church, which leads us to agape. Agape, or perfect love, unconditional love, God's love, love that transcends attraction or affection, love beyond that of familial bonds. Agape is altruistic. It's a charitable love. So much so that in the King James, certain passages translate agape as charity and not love. But our next episode will actually start our journey through this love chapter as we really pin down the love of God to learn more about who he is. We all need to love our neighbor and care for one another's well-being. Their real well-being, I might add. Not whatever they think is best for them, but whatever is objectively best for them. We should be working towards those goals. As such, there is no greater love than to lay your life down for a stranger. Most of us, however, never get that opportunity. So I will say this. If we truly love those around us and care for their well-being, that means concern for their soul and their eternal destination. Do you love others enough to share the gospel? The best thing we can do to solve the problems of the world around us is share Jesus. There is no greater transformation than sanctification. If we all looked like Christ, and we all had true agape love for one another, all of this racism and sexism and whatever else would end. Agape and its various verb forms are found all over the New Testament. About 60 to 70% of the time we see the word love in the New Testament, it is agape in the Greek, which means it is God's love. Whew! Give me a second. Ludus is a playful love. It is what makes us flirtatious and playful. But it is actually a casual form of philia and not sexual in nature. So ludus often fails because people confuse its intent for that of eros. Ludus is uncommitted. It is casual. Ludus is the friend you flirt with for fun, but don't want to be in a serious relationship with. You're infatuated with who they are, but don't necessarily have the lustful eros attraction. Physically, this is your friend of the opposite sex who's fun, and you love to flirt with, but you would never ever have a relationship with outside a casual friendship. That literally defines Ludus, and it's actually rare these days. We live in a world where it is increasingly hard to have friends of the opposite sex because of increasing sexual pressure from society and friend with benefit and hookup type scenarios. As people mature, this often turns into a philia friendship or even storge, where you feel like siblings. Ludus always becomes other forms of love and never lasts as a permanent love form. Let's get raw here for a minute, because that's what I do. That's how I roll, if you know me. I am addicted to Ludus. If you've ever been with me from the beginning, then you listened to who I am and why you should listen to this podcast. And well, you know all about the fact that all through my first marriage, I was online meeting new people, being flirty, even sexting and sending pics. And as weird as it sounds, it was never about sex or needing sex or being unfulfilled. It was about Ludus. I didn't realize that until just now. It's about the fun of getting to know someone new, being addicted to the infatuation you get when you are in that flirty stage. Moving on. Pragma is dutiful love. Pragma is the decision to love your spouse even when the warm fuzzies are gone. Pragma is about shared goals and making it work. The modern relationship has no understanding of pragma, which is why the divorce rate is so high. We value so highly Eros and the fun of Ludus that when the flame is gone, so to speak, we assume we no longer love the other person. Pragma is very much a decision. Pragma is the glue that holds long-term relationships together. Often what I have found in my own life is that feelings come and go. We change every day, based on what we eat, who we're with, internal and external stimuli, and sometimes the Eros is gone. Sometimes there is no Ludus left in the relationship. But if you decide to pragma your spouse and stick together and use your philia and storge to raise your family and stay friends, oftentimes the Eros and the Ludus return. I fall in and out of romantic love with my spouse almost on a daily basis, and I feel this is pretty normal. If I had no pragma, we would not last, and I would end up in divorce again, like most modern couples. Pragma is important. You need to decide to love those around you, because we all have bad days. And sometimes you just don't feel the love, as they say. And that's why understanding love is so important. Okay, that leaves us with one last word to cover, and it's everywhere, nearly as present as Eros. In fact, it is partly to blame for why Eros has run as rampant as it has, and that word is philautia, which is self-love. This didn't exist in the Greek. Actually, this was added by modern psychology. Don't get me wrong, self-love can be healthy. After all, Jesus tells us to love our neighbors how? As ourselves. This means that at least on some level, we are being encouraged to love ourselves in order to model that love to others. Self-love, however, quickly becomes unhealthy when you love yourself more than others, more than Christ. But we see it all around us. We selfishly give in to our eros for others out of a desire to fulfill philatelia. The cause of this? Self-esteem culture. We all have an inflated sense of self-worth, especially in America, where we take personal freedom and liberty so seriously we are willing to kill for it. We love ourselves so much that we will murder someone else in preference of our own happiness. Okay, so in ancient Greece, self-love was considered bad, which is why they didn't have a word for it. It always led to valuing oneself above even the gods, ultimately leading to one's own destruction. Think of Narcissus, the character we get the word narcissistic from. He loved himself so much that ultimately he was cursed to look at his reflection forever. Now, obviously that's just Greek myth. So what else can the Greeks tell us about the dangers of self-love? The Greeks considered self-love hubris. Today, hubris is an arrogant inflation of one's importance or accomplishments when it is not in accord with the truth. Hubris can lead to injustice, conflict, and enmity, meaning if we all loved ourselves a little less and each other a little more, all of this racism and injustice would work itself out. Let's look at a healthy self-love, at least in the Christian sense. It really comes when we replace self-esteem with Christ esteem. We are elected and adopted by the Father as brothers and sisters of Christ and therefore co-heirs to the throne of God. Did you know that? That is our identity as believers. If you are not yet a believer, don't believe the lie that we are all children of God who bear his image. The text in Romans is very clear that God adopts us as sons and daughters when we believe, which of course must mean we are not born sons and daughters. But you too can claim this identity. When our identity is found in God's image and not in some kind of hubris, we never run the risk of being more important than God. Okay. So I think we can agree love is obviously a very complex, complicated thing, at least for us humans. But God is love. God is agape. Agape is patient and kind. Agape does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Agape bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Let's check a few more translations for clarity. I actually don't like the ESV that much for this passage, which is rare. The New American Standard says agape is patient, agape is kind, and is not jealous. Agape does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Let's look at the lexem, English, for the Greek. Agape is patient. Agape is kind. Agape is not jealous. It does not boast. It does not become conceited. It does not behave dishonorably. It is not selfish. It does not become angry. It does not keep a record of wrongs. It does not rejoice at unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Yes, that is what God is. That is who God is. If God is indeed love, let's look at that idea briefly. we're going to conclude with the whole episode on the idea that God is love. But for now, let's just read 1 John, that's 1 John rather, chapter 4, verse 8. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. This was written by John, called the Beloved. So I think he may know a thing or two about the love of Christ. I know that's just one verse, but it's enough to lay the groundwork for next week. I hope you have learned at least a little bit about love, and by extension, a little about God as well. Thank you for listening to Reconstructed Faith, where we examine what we believe and question everything in order to understand it better. I hope that this has stretched your mind, touched your heart, and blessed your soul. And you are one step closer to reconstructed faith.